Chapter 25. After a two-hour wait with the nervous master of the docks, the Mikaidon came to collect Solon. The Mikaidon was the keeper of civil order in Hokkai, an office that not only put him in charge of law enforcement, but also gave him considerable political clout, as he was the only person who could investigate and search noble persons and properties. Solon recognized him. "Oshobi," he said, "you've risen in the world." Oshobi Takeda grunted.
"So it is you."
He wore the regalia of his office like a man who used it as armor, not ornamentation. Oshobi was perhaps 30, muscular and imposing. He wore his plumed helm open, of course, showing the electrum rings of Clan Takeda framing his right eye, with six steel chains connecting behind his head to his left ear. The fishes on his helm were gilded, as was his galeras, the leather and plate armor covering his left arm. His trident was as tall as he was. The type of net that dangled over his back, draping cloak-like from spikes on his shoulders, was usually edged with lead weights to help it spread out when thrown. Oshobi's net was weighted with small daggers. It could be used not only as a net, but as a shield, or even a flail by a skilled warrior. Given the numerous scars and rippling muscles on Oshobi's bare chest, Solon guessed that a skilled warrior was exactly what Oshobi Takeda had become. He had grown into his name. Oshobi meant the great cat or tiger, but Solon remembered the older boys calling him Oshobi, little pussy. Solon couldn't imagine anyone calling him that anymore. "I request the honor of an audience with Empress Wariamo," Solon said. It was a calculated statement, not asserting his own status and recognizing hers.
"You're under arrest," Oshobi told him.
In a blink, he lifted the net from the spikes on his shoulders. He looked like he wanted an excuse to use it. The man was a Cretan. Solon was a mage, and Oshobi should remember it. Of course, Solon didn't look like one. After his decade serving Duke Regnus Gyre, he looked as hard and scarred as a warrior himself, albeit one with unnaturally white hair growing in.
"On what charge?" "I do have certain rights, Mikaidon. If not as a prince," he brushed his unpierced cheek, "then certainly as a nobleman."
His heart fell. So Kado was furious. Should he be surprised?
"Your brother gave up all the Tofusin's rights. You can walk, or I can drag you."
What did my brother do? Solon had been at various schools learning magic for his brother's entire reign, and Dorian's prophecies had sent Solon to Cenaria at the time of Siguron Tofusin's death. They hadn't been close. Sig was a decade older than he was, but Solon's memories of him were pleasant. Apparently, Oshobi's weren't. Solon said,
"That's a tough one, Oshobi."
Oshobi flicked the butt of his trident at Solon's head. Solon caught the haft squarely in his hand and looked at the Mikaidon contemptuously.
"I'll walk,"
Solon said. His heart was turning to lead. During Sejuron's reign, Solon had been crisscrossing Midcryu with Dorian and Fi'ir, searching for Curoc, so he hadn't been surprised that he hadn't heard much from home. And then, when he'd concealed his own identity and headed to Cenaria to serve one of Dorian's prophecies, he hadn't told anyone back home where he was going. But now, the silence seemed ominous, and in the years since, he hadn't been able to dispel his ignorance. From the necessity of keeping his identity secret, Solon had avoided all Sethi he saw, and those who saw him spotted the lack of clan rings and avoided him as an exile. But even the usual news one might hear from foreigners had mostly been lacking, as though the Sethi people hadn't wanted to share anything with outsiders. But as they made their way to the castle, Solon soaked in the scents and sights of his old home, and some of his tension eased. This land was balm to him. He'd forgotten how much he'd missed the red hills of Agrigole. As the Mechaidon's stout, four-wheeled chariot rolled up the cobblestone road to the Imperial Palace, Solon's eyes were drawn to the west. As in most cities, the approach to the palace was jammed with buildings, homes, and shops as densely as possible. But in Seth, only the eastern side of the Imperial Way had buildings. The west side was centuries-old vineyards, rolling over the hills in perfect rows as far as the eye could see. The grapes hung heavy on the vine, and there were men checking their ripeness. The harvest would be any day. Most kingdoms required their lords to offer a certain number of men for war every summer. In Seth, the levies were needed in fall for the grapes. Already, Solon saw, enormous broad baskets had been stacked at the ends of the rows. There was no need for walls to protect the vineyards. The wines of Seth were its pride and its life's blood. No Sethi citizen would harm the vines, nor suffer a stranger to do so, and the theft of cuttings from these vines had precipitated war between Seth and Ladesh. The loss of half a dozen ships had been counted a small price when they successfully sank the Ladeshian merchantman that was carrying the cuttings back to Ladesh to begin rival vineyards, along with its escort. Ladesh had its silk monopoly, but everyone who wanted great wine bought it from Seth. To Solon, like most Sethi, the vineyards were rich, not only with beauty, but also with meaning. The cycle of planting and grafting and pruning and nurturing and waiting all resonated with meaning for every citizen. They came over the last rise, and Solon saw Whitecliff Castle for the first time in 12 years. It was white marble, a testament to the vast wealth the empire had enjoyed at its height. No white marble was quarried on the islands, and shipping it across an ocean was so expensive that every time Solon saw the castle, he was awed and almost ashamed of his ancestors' wastefulness. Outbuildings, smithies, barracks, servants' housing, barns, kennels, granaries, and storehouses ringed the hill cheek by jowl within the granite walls. But the crown of the hill was all castle. Steps, broad enough for horses, led up the first tier into the outer hall. The outer hall had a roof but no walls, leaving it oddly open to the elements. Enormous grooved marble pillars held a majestic roof of marble, onyx, and stained glass. At the base of the steps, Oshobi drew his team to a halt.
"Are you going to make this easy or hard?"
he asked. "I'm here to solve problems, not cause them," Solon said.
"Too late for that," Oshobi said. "There's a room for you on the first floor."
Solon nodded. A visiting noble would be put on the second floor, and he should have rated the third floor. But it was better than the dungeon, and it would give Kaida time to decide what to do about him. They climbed the steps together, drawing only a few looks. Oshobi was obviously a familiar sight, and Solon's clothing was Cenarian, not Sethi, so from a distance he supposed the lack of rings wasn't remarkable. Besides, it was almost harvest time, and everyone had too many things to do. Skywatchers had aided the construction of the outer hall, so the stained glass panels provided art appropriate to the season. Currently, the sun lit the whole outer hall purple with scenes of harvest and grape crushing, women dancing in vats with their skirts held up higher above their ankles than absolutely necessary, and men clapping and cheering them on. Elsewhere, there were scenes of war, of sailing, of fishing, of grand balls, of festivals to Knossos. Some of the panels were brighter than others, reminding Solon of when he was a boy and a rare hailstorm had broken dozens of panels. He remembered his father cursing their ancestors. Who would use glass for a ceiling? Of course, there was no choice but to replace the broken panes, though the price was ruinous. One couldn't let one's entryway fall into a shambles. Oshobi and Solon walked through the great black oak doors into the inner entry. Here, white staircases framed each side of the room. A great imperial purple carpet led further into the palace, and gold and marble statuary lined the hall. As they headed past the stairs to a side door, however, one of the smallest, oldest men Solon had ever seen came to Oshobi. The man stopped before he said anything, however, and gaped at Solon. He was the old Wariamo chamberlain, a slave who had chosen to stay with the family permanently rather than take his freedom on the seventh year, and he obviously recognized Solon. After a moment, he recovered and whispered to Oshobi, who promptly reversed direction and gestured for Solon to follow him into the great hall. They walked through the great hall, past decorative geometric designs and starbursts, all designed with swords and spears. It was another wasteful display, meant to send a message to visiting emissaries. "We have so many armaments. We decorate with them." It was, Solon thought, a more reasonable waste than the stained glass. The great hall was empty, except for the guards at the far door, and both of them were too young to recognize Solon. They opened the doors to the inner court promptly, so Oshobi wouldn't even have to slow. Oshobi led Solon past the great throne from which Solon's father and brother had ruled, and headed into the inner court. The doors opened at the base of stairs, braced by lions. They ascended 21 steps, and Solon felt his throat tightening. Then he saw her. Kaida Wariamo had black hair and perfect olive skin. Her eyes were deep brown, nose stately, mouth wide and full, neck slender. In keeping with the impending harvest, her hair was bound in a single tail, and her nagika was simple cotton. A nagika was a dress that looped over one shoulder, the cloth gathered to the opposite hip and falling long to the floor, fully covering the ankles, leaving one breast bare. It wasn't, as Solon had explained to Midcrayi on numerous occasions, that Sethi men didn't find breasts pleasing or innately feminine. They simply weren't erotic in the same way. In Seth, a man would comment on a woman's breasts as a Midcrayan commented on a woman's eyes. But after 10 years in Midcrayu, Solon's pulse quickened to see the woman he loved and who'd once loved him so exposed. Kaida was 28 years old now, and most of the innocent girl he had known had receded from her face. The intelligence had come more to the fore, and a steel that had once been buried deep now lay close to the surface. The holes of the clan piercings on her right cheek had long closed, but the dimples remained, showing the world she had not been born an empress. Solon thought she was more beautiful than ever. He remembered the day he had left to train with the Magi. He had kissed that slender neck, caressed those breasts. He could still remember the smell of her hair. It had been in this very room where they'd thought no one would find them. He had wondered often when she would have made him stop. Or if. But they'd never found out. Her mother, Daun Wariamo, had found them and berated them both, calling him such foul names that had he been a little older, he would have thrown her from the palace. Nor had she spared her daughter the vitriol. Solon had failed Cada there. He had allowed his own shame to keep him from protecting Cada, who was even younger and more vulnerable. It was only the first of his regrets with her.
"Oh, Cada," he said, "your beauty would shame the very stars. Why did you never write?"
The sudden softness in her eyes steeled. She slapped him, hard. "Guards, take this bastard to the dungeon!"